Welcome. A couple things I just want you to be aware of before we begin, which is I put together a list of some of the resources I used to put together my presentation. And Carol has aided me in seeing that they're all duplicated, and there's a copy outside on the table. And it looks like this. It's the Friends Conference on Religion and Psychology, and talks about some of the Pendle Hill pamphlets I used, the texts, film, music. It doesn't have everything, but it has a fair amount. And I also put out there some work I've done with a group called the Thought Leader Gathering. It started in 1999. A colleague, a friend called me. He said he wanted to begin a dialogue work in Silicon Valley in 1999. This was at the peak of the frenzy, with the premise that leadership is a function of the work we can do on the inside and with others. And I said, that is so crazy, I'll help you do it. And it has now been going on 6 times a year, every other month, from 1999 to present. We have 50, 60, 70 people who come each time. And it was a wonderful beachhead at a time when, in my world and climate, the idea that you could, that reflection might be of any use was falling out of favor, was a demonstration of how central it was. It's called the Thought Leader Gathering, and the sheet here is some of the principles of conversation we use, including in wisdom circles that make up each part of the morning. And so you'll see how they have given guidance for that. Yes. Down. Yeah. Before I was in the dark, now I'm blocked. I mean, we're going to work this. By Monday, we'll have it. Tuesday for sure. We also made a copy of the Rumi poem that I did. There may be a typo in this because I did not initially make it for a group. I just made it to read. But you'll have the typo. And it comes from the illuminated Rumi. That's the source. And finally, there's 3 pages that comes from the group I referred to yesterday, the Duck Club, that I've been part of for 20 years. And only in the last 2-3 months, we decided to actually practice dialogic work that is central to 2 of the 4 of us, but we had never really formally used it. And so my colleague, Susan Harris, put together some of the key conditions and guidance for operating with dialogue. And this is just to say there are many different processes that we have that we can develop. These are not the last words on how groups convene, but it's an example of how groups have learned to use these practices. Today and tomorrow, the talks really overlap. So I'm not sure where we'll end, but if we thought of this as a hike, what I'm hoping to do is midway through today be able to take a pause and once again use some silence and music and some reflective material for ourselves. We'll see how it is, maybe take a 5-minute break. If we can, do a little bit of interweaving of our voices, a little different than question and answer. But then after that, the next part of the hike is we're going to literally go to the cosmos and end, if we can today, or we'll start it tomorrow, with a symphony that to me is a musical analogy to collective wisdom. So there's fun. Yeah. When we're not talking about the dark side. This first part of the hike, there's a fair amount of theory, and I've dressed it up in stories. And to me, stories is one of the ways that I have to communicate, because stories have many, many dimensions to them. And what I've loved so far about my interactions is that you're already beginning to take the kinds of material I'm presenting and link it with your own lives. And I want to continue that. I want to amplify on that. The herring story. I'm going to just C told me that when he heard the music last night, it brought back not just memories, but the smell of herring when he was 12 years old and going to synagogues to honor his father who had died. And he had not had that memory or the memory of that smell for this length of time. And it just warmed my heart that the stories that I will talk about are food for your own soul. And if some of the theory is a little fast or doesn't all come together, stay with me for 4 or 5 years, we might make a dent in it. Finally, I wanted to again acknowledge how my talk was to be integrated with the small group work. In January, when we talked about all the different small groups, we listened to the kinds of themes that I wanted to present. I really had an image that where some of the more intimate engagement might be is in the small groups, and that this might be our collective experience of a talk, but I would be comforted to know that we're not just sort of hearing a talk and leaving. And so hearing the stories of what's happening in the small groups has been wonderful, from seeing the world through a soap bubble, through parsing the conference and making the analogy between the parts of ourselves that we lose or shut away and how that's analogous to what we do in groups, to exploring the shadow on a personal level, on and on to trust circles. These small groups are a wonderful extension of the kinds of material that I'm bringing forward. And as I mentioned yesterday, collective wisdom was not something I woke up with and said, here's a good idea. It was the beginning of exploring a kind of consciousness that has been with us and is in us, and that we can bring forward and amplify for ourselves and with each other. So I wanted to begin with a blessing. And yesterday I said to call in those allies that you might want for yourself. And one of the allies that I called in was John O'Donohue, who some of you may know. He was a friend. He died this year. And his spirit is so strong and so much lives on through his words. And I wanted to read a poem that he wrote about the census, because it seems in so many ways we are honoring the census in these small groups. A blessing for the senses. May your body be blessed. May you realize that your body is a faithful and beautiful friend of your soul. And may you be peaceful and joyful and recognize that your senses are sacred thresholds. May you realize that holiness is mindful, gazing, feeling, hearing, and touching. May your senses gather you and bring you home. May your senses gather you and bring you home. May your senses always enable you to celebrate the universe and the mystery and possibilities in your presence here. May the Eros of the earth bless you. May the Eros of the earth bless you. I am more visible. And if my voice softens and you can't hear, just let me know. There's a hypothesis for this work, that we are all interconnected and dependent on each other, and that together we can know more. The hypothesis, in some ways, flies in the face of reason. And yet, it is a kind of knowing that is so central to the Jungian work, to the Quaker practices, to the mysticism that is implicit in every religious tradition we have. And it is the guidance for the work that we've done on collective wisdom, to discover how that might be true. I'm going to just let you look through it. The idea here is that when we move, go to a journey, we gather some things. In myth, we're given capes that allow us to be invisible, swords, shields. And there's all kinds of assets that we have. And to become conscious of them in times of our life when it feels we are given them, and times when we become aware of how important they are for us to move through the world. And so I'm just going to read out loud the names of some of these and then return to some, because I think some are a little less familiar than others. The power of empathy. This too is me. The intent to discover the unexpected. The ability to provoke discovery in oneself and others. Psychic strength to navigate between elation and despair. Discernment to distinguish the riches of an inner life and the inflation of inner archetypes. The capacity for paradoxical thought and courage. Why are these assets? Well, empathy is somewhat straightforward. When you're in a group and you can't stand listening to someone, that ability to remind oneself that this too is me, just as the inner work is when there's a part of ourselves we detest, that is petty, that is self-righteous, that this too is me. And that's frightening. But it also creates a way of holding all the pieces without identifying with any one of them. The intent to discover the unexpected is so central in groups. Because in groups, you've heard the other person tell their story sometimes 50 times. You've heard in one form or another every other argument. And we lose that edge that there's something new I might learn. And so this asset that we have, which is that one person in the group who can still hold to the curiosity about what is unfolding here, or a question that I ask of you, allows us to keep moving forward, allows the group from just being a repetition of what we've seen before. And so we begin to realize that we have this ability, both with ourselves and with others, to provoke discovery. This next piece I wrote specifically for this, not this group, meaning you need to know this, but with this group in mind. Which is, when you care about the world, there can be such lows. There can be such times when one feels in such despair about oneself, about the world. And alternately, there are times when we can feel such elation and know that everything will work out. And so part of the assets we have is this ability to calibrate and to be aware that both, like the seasons, moves through us. In a similar way, when we begin to understand archetypal patterns and the power there is when one begins to realize that one's part of an archetypal story, and at the same time that's different than I really am the Messiah. It's a small difference. But it's a great asset to have. to know there's that distinction. Paradox is what you are also familiar with. It is this ability to constantly deal with what seems like contradictory elements, and there's nothing more paradoxical than the individual and the group. And so to work with collective wisdom has meant to find oneself in one paradoxical situation after another, but to also remember that what paradox does, like developing a muscle, is it gives us a strength to shift our orientation. And just when we think there's no resolution to the opposites, all of a sudden, it's not that one side ended up being true after all. It ends up that we have a different orientation to the very nature of the opposition. And finally, courage, because courage, the roots of the word, mean the maturation of the heart. And if we are to deal with paradox, if we are to deal with elation and despair, we have to bring forward that asset in us, the maturation of our own hearts, and to encourage, to circle others with the courage that they have in dealing and wrestling with their life. So in Parker Palmer's work, the idea that we're not advice givers is because he is trying to create a circle of trust in which each of us can find our own courage. So are you ready for the journey? That's it. You got them all? I'm going to tell a few stories that really are a way of introducing myself into this work, but also I hope kind of fill out somewhat of an archetypal canvas. So the first story begins with my own growing up in New York. My parents, as I've told many of you, were both born in shtetls in Lithuania. They came to Ellis Island. They originally lived in Pennsylvania. Were put together by a matchmaker in New York. As far as I know, for hundreds or if not thousand years, their families had lived in these areas. Both my grandfathers were cantors, which would be kind of like the rabbi as well, the person who conducts the service, who sings the songs, who holds the melodies of the religion. And when you're 13, you're prepared to inherit this tradition, to be gathered up in this community. And so at 12, for someone who is in my position, the entire year is spent preparing for this moment of the bar mitzvah. It was the totality of my parents' life and attention toward me. And what I wanted to do more than anything else was to play baseball. I had negotiated that I would wear my baseball uniform underneath my Sabbath suit. And if I left a few minutes early, I could run home. My house, strategically located exactly in the middle of the synagogue and the playing field. And stripping off my suit, not unlike Superman, I could grab my glove and continue to run because you can't drive a car on the Sabbath. It was lucky that I could even negotiate carrying a glove. And when I look back at that, I look back at the uniforms that we all wear and the uniforms underneath the uniforms. And who is the naked self behind all that? When you can no longer stay at this plane, running back and forth between the worlds above, that is when we go down into ourselves. And when I look back at the drama of that, it informs how I think about organizational work. Because it turns out that we do take up roles. We do have many uniforms. And one of the pieces that was so powerful for me in my own analysis was the persona had always been to me the false self. And I began to understand that the persona didn't need to be the false self. That we all needed a persona to interact with each other. But could it be informed by the authentic person beneath? Because that's what brings a role to life. Things would not be over for me. By 16, I was having now rebelled against 1,000 years of history. I was ready to take on public education. I was in a high school of 4,000 people. I was on the newspaper, the editorial editor, and I began to develop a critique of public education. And I wanted to share this with the principal. And my memory is I was brilliant. I went on for I don't know how long about how learning was regurgitation, how teachers just wanted you to fill in the lines. They wanted to tell you what they told you, that we were being all trained to be automatons. I went on and on like this. He stood in silence. And when I stopped, he looked at me and said, "We're preparing you for college." It was a aha that we all need mentors in our lives, and sometimes they're not the ones that we plan to have. But I understood, in a sense, I understood instantly that this was not personal, as they say in the mafia. That there was a system in place. And I was to be part of that system. And this was the rules of that system. And it was liberating. In part because I didn't have to wonder if it was just my imagination or just me. Here was the authority. He was kind enough to tell me. And the liberation was that one needs one's own imagination. One needs to depend on one's own instincts. And I did. I left the country. I announced I might never go to college. Traveled in Europe for 6 months. Every day was an adventure. You can't imagine doing that today. I wouldn't let my son do it. And later on, I became fascinated with the power of social institutions to conduct surveillance in different visible and psychic ways over our life. I became fascinated with the image of the Panopticon, which was a utilitarian philosopher in England who built a structure, a tower in the middle that could look out on a circle of cells and be able to make visible everybody in each of those cells. And it was designed for industry and prisons and actually became a model for some of the prisons in the United States. The freedom to then move on was the freedom to take up the responsibility of my own life. We're now a few years later. I am now graduating a wonderful undergraduate school, some of you may have heard, in Vermont, Goddard College, where I had traveled around the country working in healthcare centers and free schools. And I had worked with group homes in Vermont, which was a beginning movement, part of the deinstitutionalization that was occurring in Massachusetts and spilling over into Vermont. And at the time, this was the first group home in the state. No one believed it was really a model for anything except for some wackos like us who would do something like this. And that was one of the places I had worked. But when I finished college, what I had decided to do with my education degree was start an ice cream store. Wait. This was going to be not just any ice cream store. This was going to be an ice cream store for consciousness and social action. And Ed and I were going to run it, and we were going to travel across the United States looking for a place to begin it. And a few weeks before we were to leave, he called me up and he said, there's been some changes at the group home, and I'm now the executive director of it. And instead of starting the ice cream store, why don't you come and run the school? I said, that's very nice, but I have an ice cream store to start. So I went off on my own. I was convinced that this was my path. I hitchhiked through the country. I got myself into a graveyard in South Dakota. I had nowhere to sleep. I thought a graveyard might be a nice place. I don't know why. And there came a lightning storm that was the most furious I have ever been in. There were bolts hitting the ground feet from me. And I found myself talking to God. And I said, let me live, and I'll go back and run the school. I began to proceed out of the graveyard, and there was a car right at the edge of the graveyard. And there was two women inside reading a map. And somehow it didn't occur to me what it might be like for them to have someone walk out of a graveyard in the middle of a lightning storm. I have never seen a car take off that fast. I slept in a gully. But I returned to Vermont, and I ran that school for 2 years, and then went on to work with the prison system. And in 1978, the year I was finishing my work in Vermont, two friends, about 50 miles from where I was in Montpelier, two friends from Long Island, about 50 miles from where I grew up in New York, started their ice cream store. And that was Ben and Jerry. This was really the beginning of my understanding the healing and creative nature of groups. We worked with these wards of the state, diagnosed in various ways, delinquent, disturbed, and using what at the time you may remember was called milieu therapy, which is really just a way of saying that the healing is in the environment you create. And we began working in circle with these kids. And group homes became a model for the state. And I was actually appointed by the governor as part of a group that shut down the last reform school in the state of Vermont, the Weeks School. And for me, it was filling out a piece that rather than rebelling against an institution, I had to be that institution. And instead of fighting it, I had to somehow learn to take up my authority in a way that was relevant to the kids and to that system. I found myself a few years later in graduate school, and this is where I'm going to introduce some of the theory, but I'm going to try to keep it in the spirit of how I'm talking. I met a woman, Bernice Thompson, who I compare to this day as a Jedi. She would work in groups and say something, and I'd be thinking, what the hell does that have to do with anything? And people would start crying, telling the truth of their lives. What is this woman doing? Part of her work and part of what she introduced to me was the work of Tavistock, which some of you know. Some of you, if you know it in probably its different dimensions, which sometimes are quite harsh. But at the core of it was this brilliant insight about the nature of groups as wholes. One of the insights was that there are group agreements that the individual members themselves are unaware of. And I view it, even though this comes out of psychoanalytic work, I viewed it as really archaic stuff, the archetypal nature of group dynamics. And there's three orientations I'll quickly mention to you, because you'll recognize them to varying degrees. One is dependency. A group acts as if it needs someone to give it permission. And it could be a dependency on a person, it could be a dependency on a text, but people will not take up their own lives, they will not take up their own authority in deference to this dependency that they've created among themselves. And if you go into a group that is deeply in a dependent place and you say, come on, we can do it, there is a flatness to the response or a friendliness to the response that's telling you, we've heard it before. So too can a group orientation be fight and flight. And this is the most archetypal. What is fight and flight? We know it in our own bodies. We're threatened, we either leap or we run away. Physiologically, we're getting to know a lot more about it. Blood flows to the thighs. Why? Because you're going to run or leap at someone. Less activity in the neocortex, which is where there's more sophisticated brain functioning. Hormones are released that pump up the heart. What happens in groups that don't actually have the physical threat is people begin fantasizing about when they're going to take their next trip to Hawaii. Or they can't wait to get into an argument over something, and it really doesn't matter what. I took my kids from the group home to see a movie at the time, probably Billy Jack or something. No time at all were they fighting over if Billy Jack could kick Bruce Lee's ass, right? I mean, it didn't matter. And pairing is in some ways the most complicated, because the words can be elusive. Usually talks about the power of two people in relation to the group. But it really is, I think, Bion who helped articulate these ideas, his way of talking about the messianic ideas that can get into groups. And that in groups that are pairing, there is always some greater idea that's going to save the world or save the group. And the group is unable to actually get much done because you're really wed around, if only others would realize the power of this great idea, or if only we would understand the power of this great idea, then all our problems would go away. Dependency, fight and flight, and pairing are not static, meaning you could be in a group and, like weather patterns, move from one to the other. I don't think you try to cure these kinds of groups. I don't think you try to cure dependency, if you will. What they're useful is to help one navigate oneself in a group and to be able to be selective about how one uses one's energy in a group. I was asked if I could explain pairing again. It is an unconscious agreement in a group that if people could join together around an idea, a text, maybe two people in the group who seem to want to take the group somewhere, that all their problems will be solved. And the way they showed up in the collective wisdom group is there's an element in all of us, especially if you do this work with collective wisdom, if somehow we just had collective wisdom, all our problems would go away. So tell me what collective wisdom is so all our problems can go away. And when I work, and these are my colleagues, I am always looking for where we move from talk to execution. Because some things to be created take extensive periods of time. I can't use a map of, well, if we've only talked once and not got anything done, we must be a pairing group. But I'm very alert to what seems to be the intent of the group or the members in the group that I'm working with. Are we to get something done? Even if it takes years. Or are we going to somehow still come back to, if only we understood this better and the true source of knowledge, then all these problems would fix themselves? So pairing is an extremely elusive idea, and you have to in some ways experience it in a group to understand the power of it. And the only clue I can give you is it has to do with the group's ability to actually get things done. What I was adding is a PS, that by that I don't mean within 2 minutes or 5 minutes or two meetings or five meetings, but it's an instinct whether a group is going to act on something.
Does the pairing come from that there's something between the two people to get started, or is the pairing some other way to do
it? Yeah, both ways. I think that often the reason it came to be called pairing is because it's two people in the group. You know, it could even be a husband and wife that people gather around. It could be two people who are friends. It could be two people who are beginning to have a romantic relationship, bringing all this energy into the group. But it also can be a pairing with something that's actually not human. It can be with an idea. And so religion, of course, and religious practices are always susceptible to certain kinds of pairing orientations. If we really understood God, or if we really took Christ into our heart, or all the different ways we say these things. I bring up this just to say one of the further applications of what it means to understand that when you're in a group and there's five people, there's five different organizations that are existing. And the Grubb Institute was a sister organization of Tavistock in London. By the way, if you had to name an institute, would you name it Grubb? That's just a throwaway question. It was Sir Lord Grubb was the beneficiary, but they weren't that at that time worried about branding, obviously. That the work of the Grubb Institute, which is brilliant work and something I was initiated into, is this idea that each person has an organization in the mind. And if you take the Tavistock work, right, and begin to say how that gives each person a different orientation to what's happening in the group, they begin to develop an entire world. When I do consulting, and I've worked in one organization for 20 years, I'm always trying to understand the way the person puts together that organization in their mind, because that's going to inform me about how they take up their role. And it was in that concept of that there's an organization in the mind that we begin to take up a role. For many people, just like persona, role has a somewhat ambivalent feel to it. But in the way the work evolved for me, the highest work one does is to figure out what is the role. Now, some people say, well, is your role being honest in the group, or is your role playing a psychological part to the group? I'm really talking about how one infuses a positional role in an organization with the authenticity of your own life. That when I work with physician leaders, there's a real distinction between the person who says, I'm here in my position to see that we cut 15% out of supply costs, and the person who says to me in many different ways, we are here because we were asked and entrusted to care for people's lives. And if we have to find ways to reduce the cost to do that, I will do that. I will help people find a way to do that. But what infuses the work is an understanding and alignment with why the organization exists. And that, to me, is the highest form of taking up a role. A distinction I made that is actually not in the Grubb work, but comes from a woman in the early 1900s, Mary Parker Follett, and I thought is very useful for, again, this group, is her language of power with versus power over. Which she saw in the early 1900s, as we still see today, that much of power is about a certain kind of domination. In this thought leader gathering, one of my colleagues broke out in the song, Mack the Knife, because we were talking about how many people confuse leadership with subtle forms of coercion. And if you listen to the song Mack the Knife, they're actually not usually showing you the knife. It's always hidden. You've seen it or heard about it. And so much of power is used in that kind of way. But power with is such a central idea, because if you couldn't use the word power, if you couldn't talk about how we want to affect each other, then it's very hard in groups to create the satisfaction of getting something done and feeling purposeful. So I use that distinction just to help us use the language of power, not just as one thing, but to think about it as having a real distinction about whether it's used as a form of domination or used truly in alliance with others. I want to introduce a piece of Carl Jung here, because he was such an important part of my own learning. And this was a speech he gave at Yale. And notwithstanding the fact that I've been called a philosopher, I am an empiricist and adhere to the phenomenological standpoint concerned with occurrences, events, experiences in a world with facts. Psychological existence is subjective insofar as an idea occurs in only one individual, but it is objective insofar as it is established by a society, by consensus gentium. This point of view is the same as that of the natural science. An elephant is true because it exists, Jung argued. It is neither a conclusion, nor a statement, nor a subjective judgment of a creator. It is a phenomenon. Photographed this in South Africa as an elephant burst out. What Jung was getting at, and he did this throughout his work, is that there was a phenomena that was not to be confused with either philosophy or the subjective nature of each individual, but an archetypal objective reality to the psyche that could be known by studying how it appears throughout time and in different cultures. And it's partly through that that he begins to define for himself the collective unconscious. And so while subjectivity is a crucial part of our interaction with people, he was also laying a foundation for us to think about what is collective among us as a human species. Another story. Just want to check. When I was doing my doctoral dissertation, which eventually became called Institutionalization of the Soul and led to my book, The Stirring of Soul in the Workplace, I had become now deeply involved with the Jungian work, and I was doing the origins of social institutions such as prisons, mental asylums, and public schooling in the United States. You're laughing. Because I believe there was a blueprint that had to do with all those institutions having to manage people. And this was actually somewhat of a unique phenomenon, that other than the military and the church, people did not have to be organized. This comes as we leave the agrarian economy and move into industrial spaces and gather people together. So the saboteur comes from those early industrial places where the French threw his sabot, his shoe, into the mechanics of the machinery to stop it. And I didn't know where I could go with this. And I was literally waking up in the middle of the night in cold sweats. I knew that there was something about shadow that I wanted to talk about, but I didn't know how to bridge it to a collective. I walked into a bookstore, I went to a magazine rack. On the cover of this magazine rack was my dinner with Andre, an interview with Andre. I open up the magazine right to the interview, and I read Andre saying, "And we must begin to understand how the shadow has a collective aspect. And the best book on this is by Eric Neumann in his book, Depth Psychology and the New Ethic." It's a small used bookstore. I walk to the back to the very small section on used psychology books, and there is Eric Neumann waiting for me. I'm going to speak a moment about how I opened the book, and I'm going to read you this section. But the synchronicities that we are talking about is what gets activated when there is a deep question we are living with, when there's an unresolved piece, that when we're willing to take that journey into our inner world and the outer world begins to reflect back to us, and we're now leaving simple ideas of cause and effect or causality, that synchronicities begin to occur for us when we enter into this other realm, when there's something inside that needs to be call and response to the outside. And what I open to, and I must, as for full honesty, I don't actually remember what I opened to at the time, but years later, I opened, and this is what I opened to. The polarization of these opposite positions, the self-assurance of the ego on the one hand, and the ever-increasing pressure of the dark side on the other, leads finally to a split in the personality of both the individual and the group. Eric Neumann, a Jew writing in the shadow of World War II, was able to say that what he had seen was still a dress rehearsal for what was to come. That the attempt to be master of the ego, to ward off what was uncomfortable, had its counterpart in the group life. And that this tearing asunder would create like an opportunistic infection for all kinds of projective material. You could see why Jung, who could never really tolerate groups, but who had a great insight about collectives, would say that first you have to take the stone out of your own shoe if you want to help anyone. Now, in my work, I don't think it's an either or. I don't see it as a sequence. But there is no question that as we do this work for ourselves, we open a door into how it can also live in groups. For Jung, the God image was alive in the center of our being, the self. Although the images may change over time, God does not. This is Jung's own image that he drew of the self. Jung believed, in a way I think was preliminary to where we are now, that the great discovery of the collective unconscious gave us a rationale that there was a power to the human species, that we were not separate from each other, and that we would need in some fashion, even if it was through a river of blood, to discover this. The wonderful story of the two knights, the red and black knight in the forest, who meet and mortally wound each other, and as they're lying, take off their helmets and discover their brothers. Can that discovery occur before we are mortally wounded? So this is part of the hike where we rest a little. And let's just take a few moments in silence. I want to pose a question here. What if the same forces that are driving us are also allowing us to discover unifying principles? Thomas Merton, as you know, the Christian mystic, had terrible back problems and he had surgery on his back. And one of the stories of his life is that he fell in love with the nurse who was taking care of him. And while there are various versions of what this meant and was it appropriate, what was powerful for me was the image of him waking up in bed and feeling this feminine presence and feeling he understood something that he had never himself really had understood before, given his own separation from his mother. And he writes these words: "There is in all visible things an invisible fecundity, a hidden wholeness. This mysterious unity and integrity is wisdom, the mother of all. There is in all things an inexhaustible sweetness and purity, a silence that is the font of action and joy. It rises up in wordless gentleness and flows out to meet me from the unseen roots of all created being, welcoming me tenderly, saluting me with indescribable humility. This is at once my own being, my own nature, and the gift of my Creator's thoughts and art within me, speaking as Hagia Sophia." The previous quote was Thomas Merton. Yes, I believe so. Yeah. So I want to introduce someone else into this conversation. That's William James, who was one of the founders of psychology in the United States, who Jung met as a young man, and who wrote these words later in his life. And I'm introducing this as a prelude to where I want to move to closure, at least for the first half of today, of this talk. And I want to tell you where I'm going with it. What would it be like if we could look down at the earth from above? What different way of knowing if we had this telescopic way of looking at ourselves as an entire planet? And so I'm going to take you from 1909, where William James is glimpsing something, to Edgar Mitchell talking about the return from the lunar landing on the moon. And it just as, again, background to how this found its way into my talk, is Edgar Mitchell began the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And when they moved their facilities to Northern California, we were the first group, the Collective Wisdom Group in its early version, to stay at that facility. And I was with my group and we were talking and telling stories, and I saw this man across the way smoking a cigarette. And I always love having a cigarette when I see someone having a cigarette. And so I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll go over and introduce myself and, you know, bum a cigarette. And just as I was thinking that, he comes walking over. I lose all sense of courtesy. I don't introduce myself. I don't say hello. I say, "You have a cigarette?" And he says, "No, I left it back at the cabin." And Tom, my co-author, kind of like hits him. He says, "Alan, do you know who this is? A guy without a cigarette. You know, you tell me, you know." He said, "This is Edgar Mitchell." And Cheryl, my other co-author, we begin talking to him. He talks about starting the institute, and Cheryl asks him, was there any connection between your going to the moon and starting the Institute of Noetic Sciences? And he just warms up and starts telling us the whole story, which at the time I didn't know he had told many times. And as he's telling it, tears well up in his eyes. And it's like he is living it all over again. And I'm going to bring you a clip of his talking about this, not with me, but in another setting, in a documentary that was made about people who've gone to the moon. So I'm going to read the William James piece, and then we'll go into the Edgar Mitchell piece. We'll soften things with a bit of music, and then see. Now, give me an idea. Do you need to take a 5-minute break now? Yes? No? Yes, no, let's hear it. We have to have it emerge. Why don't we take 5 minutes, but not make it 15? And that's what I want, is to, for you to be in a good space for this next piece. So it's actually to my benefit if you go and stretch and come back. 5 minutes.